All right. Good afternoon. Welcome to the last session of the conference. Thanks for showing up. I was already afraid that this would be an empty show. My name is Gert Drapers. I'm a program manager in the SQL Server team. This last session, we're going to talk about building OData services. The focus is on dynamic and scalable. If you look at the brochure, there used to be secure. The reason why I removed that, because I cannot get ACS to work for the best of me. So I spent just 4 hours to get ACS to work, and I gave up. So sorry about that. It's like must be jet lag or something else. So how many of you have tried building an OData service? Just a handful. Of those who haven't, how many of you know what OData is? Okay, good. All right. That saves me some time. All right. That's fine. You know who I am. So OData. So the main thing to understand before we start is I explicitly distinguish two things. OData, the protocol, and the implementations that you can use, like WCF Data Services, OData Lib, the WCF Data Services Toolkit, for example, which help you build OData services. And the reason why I'm making the distinction is that WCF Data Services is probably the easiest way to get started. But it's also the easiest way to get stuck. So that's why we're actually going to dive into how you can leverage WCF Data Services and extend it to build more scalable services and more dynamic services. All right? So that's why I'm distinguishing between the protocol and the implementation. Because the protocol is actually quite flexible, and it defines a whole set of options and capabilities which are not necessarily always represented in the implementation. So OData is a Atom Pub protocol. We're layering it on top of HTTP. You can switch the format from Atom Pub to JSON. The first thing that every client almost does is ask for metadata to describe the entities that you're exposing. You're interacting with it through URI queries. So there is a URI convention that you're actually using. And then it's like the most important thing is that we're basing this on the REST semantics, so HTTP GET PUT for getting things done. It's based on an open protocol, so there is a specification that you can go. You can go to this website and go from there. The other part is like that the client source is actually open, so it's like it's released under the Apache license, so you can download it from odatacodeplex.com. And there is a huge feedback on my mic. And there is a bunch of SDKs for devices that you can actually leverage to consume OData feeds. And that's an interesting part because the way it's set up, you can communicate over HTTP, you're transporting regular JSON or Atom feeds. You can consume this on a wide variety of devices. And that's what makes OData really interesting. So the first thing that you actually do is, from a data model point of view, is we need to come up with a service document, as we'll see in a minute when we dive into our first demo. All right, the service document, what does the service document describe of the service? It lists the entities that are being exposed by the data service. So that's your first clue about what is actually accessible, and then you can start to navigate from there. You can ask for a $metadata, which effectively gives you the structure of the entity and the navigation properties on the entity and the service operations that are available on inside the service documents. You use format options to determine is like how you want to return things. So if you want JSON feedback, you have to specify that you want a format option. The default is add and pop, as I said. And then it's like you have a set of query options. Now, the query options is an interesting topic because it's like not all query options by definition are supported, especially when we go and look at custom providers. You have to do work. So the way that you navigate through relationships is through this URI convention. So in this case, there is a collection of entities called cities, which you selected on the primary or the identifier that you exposed. You can only identify one identifier. All right, so you, even if you have multiple unique keys on a data set, there is only one that you identify that you can put between the parentheses and use them as an accessor. If you want to use them or access them on a different, the secondary key, it's like you would have to do that through an equality operation. So the other thing is that you have to, in order, if you want to have a performing server, you will have to start thinking about what is it that you're going to expose, how you're going to drive paging, and what is the query behavior that you have. So for those of you who are using SQL, the other part that you need to be aware of is that since it's a REST-based implementation, it's by definition stateless, as you might expect. So how do you know if your result set is still valid? Are we awake? Hello? So what do? You add a row version. All right, which, what does a row version do? Every time the record changes, the row version changes. And so the logic that you use is you fetch information, you keep hold on to the row version. Normally, you don't expose the row version to the consumer because it's useless. All right, and you assign that to the etag inside your OData structure. And then when you send things back, or the user is actually returns things, you compare if the etag that you had is the same as the etag on the server. If the etag on the server is different, you know that the world has changed underneath you, and the proper thing to do is to fail. Right? But you have to do this. Otherwise, you have no way to detect who made a change. Because one of the things that you will see is that you can actually serialize your object graph on the client, right? Hold on for it, and then deserialize it. And now you need to know is like what the state of the world is. So if you look at the implementation of WCF data services, so it is a HTTP endpoint. There is the data services runtime. Now, the WCF name in data services, in my opinion, is really more lip service. I would say lipstick on a pig. That's not really what I wanted to say. But it's more paying lip service to the WCF stack because, like, a lot of the functionality, like, you can change out your channel. You can change out the formatters. You can do with WCF data services. It's tied to an HTTP implementation, and you're tied to the formatters that you have to use. So there are a bunch of providers that sit underneath by default. So the most easy one to get started is using the Entity Framework one. And the reason why is that, well, as we will see in a moment, what did we expose from the data set is a set of iQueryables. And so what does Entity Framework expose? It's a set of iQueryables. So as soon as you create your setup inside Entity Framework, you have your entity set defined, you have your context, you can pass the context to your data data services runtime, and it will be able to negotiate or interrogate the context through reflection, right, and go from there. The second option is that we actually use the reflection provider. Actually, I said it's like entity framework. We don't have to go through reflection. We can actually interrogate the entity structures directly. If we don't have the entity model available ourselves, the next option is to use the reflection provider. And the reflection provider will look at the structure of the classes that you return or the link classes that you actually return. This is linked to objects specifically. And then go from there. We talked about that. So the key thing to remember about reflection provider is that although it looks fast, right, under the covers it's doing link to objects, manipulations over your object graphs or your result sets, your enumerables that you're returning. So you will have to make sure that the sets that you're actually exposing are properly exposed, and you have less control over how the metadata is being actually returned. The only control that you have is through attributes, as we'll see in a moment. So let's build our first service, or I'm actually not going to build it because, like, I hate typing and I'll make mistakes anyhow. I already had it open, sorry. No. Okay. All right, what do we have here? Let's start with, actually, hold on one moment. Let's get this guy going. Yes, all right. So what do we have? We started with a very simple entity framework model. I didn't do anything special. I just did the dumb thing. Point it to a database, extract it, create a model. All right, this is not an entity framework talk. All right, so what the end result of that is that we have the entity relationship metadata being exposed, right? So all our assemblies are there. And I have a context, an object context, which contains all the entities, and then all the entity definitions. That's all I need. Okay? So how do we expose that? Now, we could take the WCF data services approach and say it's like create servers and go from there. I sort of hate that approach. And the reason why I hate the approach is from a debugging point of view, I don't like that much. I'm more a command line guy. So I always start with this structure. I basically create a very small command line where I host my web service. All right, I create a web service host. I pass in the type of the data service that I want to use. And I pass in the URL of this where I want to host my service. All right, that gives me complete control over what I want to do. And it's the easiest and smallest framework for me to get started. So I then bind it to the service, right? So pony up a request handler, open my host, and then I'm sitting there waiting for somebody to hit a key if I want to break. Most of the times I'll already be gone because I hit a breakpoint in the debugger or broke into the debugger. The next thing that we have to do is create our service class. This is where the first part of our data service is going to be created. So couple of things. So we create a data service class which implements data service of T. All right, so this is the type that we're implementing. And in this case, what we're doing is we're asking it to implement the data service over the object context that is being returned by the entity framework. All right. So the data service implementation will then go enumerate over the EDM model underneath in the entity framework definition, and expose that. We initialize the service, and this is where we actually have some or flexibility that we need to think about in terms of who can actually access the entity sets. If you have service operations, who can access those? What is the protocol behavior that you want? Is that version 1, 2, or 3? Right, if you have version 3, you can actually do JSONP. And the most important one to not forget is to attribute your class with the system behavior that says include exceptions. If you don't do that, you don't get very meaningful output while you're debugging. Right? Most people look at, they figure out that it's like they can use verbose errors and set it to true, but they still don't get a lot of info, so don't forget to actually put that attribute on top of it. All right, so let's run it. Sexy, right? All right, so let's pony up this guy here. So I ask it to go to the service document, right? Which for me right now, and this is another advantage, if you use WCF data services, your service document will always end on .svc. Personally, I don't like that much because that's not what I want to expose to the outside world either. So I just want to use the service name that I want to put on the URI. So the first thing it does is actually return the service doc that lists out all the entities that are being exposed. So right now, this is going against Northwind. So we find the typical things that we would find in Northwind. Right, that we have inside our collection. The next thing that we need to be able to do is ask for the metadata. Right, and that gives us the definition of the entity itself. So in here, you will see it's like that the entity type category, it's like you have a property in there called category ID, I'm sorry. Right, and then it has the EDM notation. So inside, when you're inside the entity framework provider, this information is directly available at very low cost. Right. Now the downside of the entity framework provider is nobody? I would expect tomatoes by now. But what's going on? You guys want to go home? No, it's like there are a couple of downsides to use the entity framework. It only supports rectangular shapes. OData supports semi-structural shapes. I will not be able to get semi-structural shapes back from entity framework. It's limited to the set of entity framework providers that you have, so that's effectively SQL, Oracle, IBM. Right. There are a couple more, but it's not much. And a lot of times you actually want to expose data that is not necessarily coming out of a database. So what I see people do as a result is they push stuff into a database first and then expose it to OData, which is like, wow, thank you. But not necessary, all right? But I understand it's an easy way to get. So okay, so we can do the basic things right as we expect. So let's actually go back to our service doc real quick. Right. So let's do orders. Okay, so here I get my orders. And so one of the things that you will find is like, okay, so here we have our orders. Here we have order ID. Now the key thing is like, what can you get there from there? What is the next step? And that's always exposed in the related aspects. So this is the restfulness of the protocol, right? It's like we're actually, it's like the result set describes what the next possible actions are. All right, you can go in there and say, I can go ask for a shipper based on my order. So that's, now we know that that's available or a viable option to go down to. So every time or every result set actually has that information. So let's go for, where is my order ID? So by the way, if you don't want to do this inside VS, or you can of course always do it in here. By default, you have to turn off your RSS feed because otherwise you will get this as just regular stuff. So here it says, it's like, what is my href, right? So this is how I can actually get the specific order. So I can go here. Come on, thank you. All right, and return one order back. So it's like what you see is here is like, and this is just the basics, and we'll move on because that's not why you're here. All right, but it's like all the information is always in the result set. So that allows you to write a different kind of application to begin with. For those of you who raised your hand saying is like, I built OData services, or I'm consuming OData services, how many of you use a proxy? Great. Perfect. Anybody cares to share why not? Nobody? Oh, come on now. The main reason being is like, if you start to... So you can go into Visual Studio and say, generate me a proxy. What do? You create yet another strongly typed solution. How quickly is this going to change? Well, faster than you think. And on most, well, Northwind not. Okay. Thank you. So that's not the point, right? But it's like, you want to be able to write applications that if your service is changing, that your app keeps it still running. If you're pushing an app onto a Windows phone, or an iPhone, or a Droid, or a tablet, right? It's like you want it to continue to work even though you're revving or changing the service. Which is why it's like you really want to prevent using proxies to begin with. Right. Yes, it's easy, allows you to do a lot of stuff, but then it's like you don't go from there. All right, so let's stop with the basic stuff, break this, okay, clean this up. All right. So that's all there is to it. One simple command line tool, a data services definition, my attributes, and an entity set that exposes an object context, which I'm going to pass in to my data service of type T, right? And there I'm going. That's all I need. So remember that structure because we'll see that back later. So we've seen these two providers. Now, if you really want to do something different, you end up writing a custom provider. Now, I will show you a framework, and that's available, actually. So it's like you can just fill in the blanks. It's not that hard. And if you go to the WCF data set tool, data server toolkits, it's like it's even easier. Why did you want to do this? Well, first of all, there are, as I said earlier, there are data shapes that you want to be able to support that the other ones don't provide to you. Okay. Reflection doesn't provide you enough control. Reflection doesn't provide you with performance. Because every time it will ask, you'll go into the class, it's like it will actually reflect over the object. So that's pretty detrimental to your performance. And in a lot of cases, you need to be able to have access to what is being done. So especially with regards to streaming and paging, for example, you might have smarter things that you want to implement. So at that point in time, you actually need to create a provider which implements those interfaces and provide that back to the WCF data services. So there are a couple of variations that you have to think about when you start this work. Am I going to be a typed provider or am I going to be an untyped provider? What does that mean? Well, is the information that I'm exposing, do I have backing inside the provider of strongly typed classes that I can bind to? Or do I really need to bind at runtime? All right. The untyped provider is more work, but it does give you more flexibility. Am I a read-only or read-write provider? The reason why that's an interesting question is, like, if you're read-only, you only have to implement the query provider, right? Which effectively is the projection over your data set or your result set. If you are read-write, you also have to implement update, insert, and delete, right? Which is more work. So you have to ask yourself that question. Then the next one is, like, are you going to support navigation? What does that mean? Are you going to have navigation properties on your entity? So example that we saw a moment ago, I could go from orders to shippers. So I'm on an order, I can find out who ships it and move to the shipper entity. That's a navigational property that you would have to implement. So now it's like you would have to implement your context traversal that takes the information and allows you to navigate over your object graph and pass the context from one side to the other. Do you have big objects to return? In which case, you need to implement streaming support. All questions that you have to ask yourself, ideally before you start. Right? Because otherwise, it's like you might be wandering down the wrong path. So let's look at the skeleton and what you need to do there. So all these things will be available, don't worry. So that's a custom. Yes. All right. So I broke it up in two projects, actually. So one is, again, the same service skeleton, right, which has my launch point in program, my data service, which provides me the context that I'm passing on to the data service of T. Some helper classes that are not really relevant in this implementation, and then the provider itself. So the provider always needs a set of objects. It needs to have your context, which is the equivalence of your object context that you're passing in. This is where the provider goes to figure out where to go, to ask for the instances for the interfaces that you implement. All right. So it asks for the metadata service and the query service. The most minimalistic provider that you can create only implements the context, the data service class, the data metadata interface, and the query provider interface. That's the most minimalistic thing you can do. That's about 20 minutes of work to get it to go based on some class that you want to expose. Right. Anything that goes beyond that, you actually have to go and do a lot more work. Now, the thing that you need to do first, so let's hit my servers. Okay, so it's open. Let's actually use another tool to play with this. Let's open up LinkPad. So LinkPad is actually a pretty handy tool in case you haven't never used it. So LinkPad actually by default has built-in support for OData. And it allows you to craft queries over your objects using Link, which allows you to much more easily express varieties of queries that you otherwise would have to express on the URI. I always get tired of typing things onto the URI. And the other thing is, like, it has a very nice result set, and it has an editor that you actually helps you with IntelliSense. So that's good. So the first thing that we do is we actually pony up a new context. That's the first thing. So data services at this point in time is invoking the provider. All right. So what we do here is, like, we actually have a data source create, which we instantly hand off to the context that we have inside our worlds. What are we going to do in the context? In the context, we're actually going to create the result set for our documents, service documents. So what we're going to do here is we're going to resolve a set of resource sets that will contain the information that describes the entities that we're going to return. So in this case, it's like we have products, categories, and suppliers, and then we're going to have an address type, and we're going to put some information in there, and then we're going to create some resource objects for each of them. Create some relationships, and for each relationship, we're going to set up some context. All right, you don't want to see me step through this. And the last thing is we actually register a service operation, which is called get products by rating. Okay? That's not what I wanted. Okay. I changed my code. All right, so LinkPad was able to retrieve the information, and this gives you a much more useful view of the world, actually, while you're going through this. So you saw that we created a resource set per entity type where you describe every property in there. You provide information about the relationship, which shows up as a nav prop on your entity. All right. And it's like you can actually ask for the information. So here we go. Oops, hit breakpoints. And this returns your test result set that you actually created. So you saw me create some test entries in that class. And right now, this is all still skeleton work. So what I did is I actually created a full provider skeleton with every possible interface that you can just rip, copy, and start implementing your own stuff. Fine. So this actually will get you going pretty quickly in terms of figuring out is like where things, what are the things that you actually need to go do. So let's go. So I always use the same data service. So here we go. Let's put this back. All right. So we also have a service op that we exposed, right? So what is a service op? Well, a service op is really a static method call, right? That is, doesn't have any context to the entity itself. In this case, what we're doing is we're trying to actually get the service op, so that's our the place where we're actually getting into the framework. All right, we tried to resolve this. Oops, I did that wrong. right, which actually resolves to this lambda expression that we're going to call. I'm not sure why I didn't get a breakpoint. Probably because it timed out. All right. First problem of the day. Good one. Right. Not sure why I'm not getting there right now. I'm getting the invocation, so I must be missing something here. Let's do this one more time, see if we can. Let's put my breakpoint back. All right, so let's go. Does this give me a service operation? Yes. It has one parameter. It's rating. Okay. Sorry. Anybody know? I'll show you. Me, ignorance. Okay, there we go. Go there. Go up there. There we are. All right, finally. So what do you get when you actually enter your static function? Well, you can always pass the context. This is why ponying up that context is important, because this is how you carry session information into your framework. So if you're doing security, as I said, which I pulled out of the session right now because I couldn't get it to go. It's like you would have a handler. So as soon as you get the invocation, what you would do is you would actually validate your security context there. How do we pass security context? Well, we can leverage the WCF data services framework for things like NTLM and Kerberos. But if we want to do something more fancy and use OWASP or ACS, for example, with a Yahoo provider, it's like we have to stuff that into the header. Right. The downside right now is that the standard clients don't all expose that. It's like some of them do. Is like, for example, LinkPad has a facility to pass in OWASP, but for example, the Explorer objects don't. So this actually gets you there. It's like you pass in the context, you pass in your parameter, which was passed in to the lambda expression, as we saw. We're going to run that query. In this case, we simply implement it as a link to objects query. And so we're returning the results as an iQueryable. All right. That's being returned. And here we go. That is being flown into the lambda expression. And then it's like we're going to render that. And if I'm not mistaken, I should have one result. Okay. So that's how you actually navigate through. Now, as of OData 3.0, we'll add actions. Actions are actually method calls on top of entities. Right, so this allows you to have a method call based on the entity context that is being returned. Right. I don't have a good example for that now, I'm sorry. OData 3 is not officially released. It's like it's still in CTP. The last update was in November. That's what I'm using, so I could have done that, but sorry, haven't. All right. So that's our framework, right? As I said, it's like, so the next thing is like, so you have to implement the metadata provider. Now, the key thing to remember is that what the provider will do by default is it will do a try resolution first. So it gives you an opportunity to actually implement caching. And I would strongly advise that if you build your own provider, you cache your metadata. Because otherwise, it's like you spend most of your time resolving metadata information over and over and over again. where that's not really necessary. Okay? So these two try, resource set and resource type, these allow you to do that actually, because if they fail, it's like you go down the other code paths and actually populate it. Right? So you fault in, the mental model that you should have is that you're faulting in your metadata. All right, so you wait for the first request. The request is going to ask you something. All right, that also gives you scope of what you're being asked about. And so we'll see actually why that is important in the next sample that I have. Because if you bring back the whole world, it's like you're going to flood yourself. And that's not a good idea. All right. So after you've done the metadata provider, which these two try resource calls, or actually tree, sorry, is like we also have one for service ops. Those are the three important calls that you have. You can actually set your resources to be read-only. What that means is that you're locking down your resource set. So once you've constructed your list of resource types or entity types and properties, you can then close on them by calling read-only on them. And what that means to the framework is that we now know that they're locked and that they can actually rely on this, that it doesn't change. So they use that information down the pipeline. So after you're done with the metadata provider, the next thing to go do is actually build up your query provider. All right, and so right now it's like we have a link query provider in here. Now the link query provider is actually cheating. I'll show you another one in a minute. Because like here what we're doing is we're relying on link to help us implement the iQuery provider. And I'm not sure how many of you implemented an iQuery provider, but that's not an easy task. If you want to do that with full fidelity, make sure that you have all your where clause handling, all your filters and projections being handled, that's actually a significant task that you would have to do. Which is why, because you have to walk over the expression, which is why we ship an expression visitor that allows you to walk over the link expression tree that you're going to get. Because what is it that you're going to get from the framework? A link query tree. Right? And you need to navigate over that tree, interpret what is in there to figure out what to do with it. Now, it's very easy, which is like is this code that we have here, if you have objects and you're using link to objects to now project over your own sets. But that makes one very important assumption, that all your data is memory resident in some class instance. That's probably not very feasible, unless you only have Dinky Toy services. Right, which is probably not the case. So that's why you have to be very careful with how you're going to do this. Because if you're going to assume that you can load all your objects in memory, you're going to be busted. So you have to become a lot smarter. All right, so we'll look at the update provider in the next one. So let's go here. All right. Thank you. So one of the projects that I used OData for was in my previous life. If you were in my previous sessions, like you know what I did. It's like I worked on the directory. And so one of the things that I was trying to do was expose the directory information using OData. Now, you also know from my talk that it's like we actually used as a store, we used SQL Server underneath. And one thing that I didn't want to do during development, and actually never, was having to deal with metadata providers. So I wanted to have a dynamic system where if I changed my structure, my service would change. Right? And that seemed like a very trivial example, where it's like you point OData to a database, and you say, like, expose it. Right? And that's exactly what the next sample will do. Now, the key thing is like that you have to remember, I said this multiple times already, the provider is called multiple times in the code pass to figure out is like the shape of things, how we can project. So again, you have to cache that. The other question that you have to ask yourself, which might not be as obvious, is like, so the dollar metadata, right? So this, exposing the service document is one thing. What do you want to do with dollar metadata from a security point of view? Are you going to expose that over an anonymous call? Or are you requiring that somebody authenticates? All right, that's a choice that you may need to make. All right, if you want to leverage the tool system, like Visual Studio or tools like LinkPad, or like having Excel and Power Pivot points to your OData service, right now it's like you have to make this guy exposed over anonymous call. Any call after that, you can ask for authentication or security context. But it's like those two calls, like the service documents and the metadata documents, are the two things they expect to always get at. Maybe a wrong assumption, but that's how the world is living right now. All right, so let's look at our SQL Server OData provider. So, oops, that's not what I want to do. I'm sorry. Okay. So this is actually a slightly more elaborate one, as you see. So this is a full functioning provider that allows you to point it to a SQL Server, and we'll read the metadata, we'll turn it into a resource set, and have you interact with the service. Okay? So let's first look at it while it's up and running. So I have my service being open. Let's do it this way. Okay. Refresh this guy. All right. So as you see here, it's like now I have full Northwind at my availability. Now you would say it's like, yeah, well, you might be just pulling my leg here, right? Because that might be anything. Sorry? Where do the icons come from? Oh, that's simply, that's LinkPad. Yeah, that's not us. We don't deal with icons. No, it's like they look at the metadata, and based on the metadata, they use a different icon. So this is nav prop. This is the identifier. Right. And so let's actually change this. Because right now it's like it's hardwired, like you would expect for a demo. Sorry. So I'm going against my local instance right now. So let's go against identity. All right, refresh. Here we go. All right. So right now it's like, so the way this is set up is like, as I said, right now it is like I don't pass in the database as the context. I hardwired it. The framework actually is set up that you can go look up. So the implementation is the user logs in, that the full demo was the user logs in. You look up which database the user is mapped to, and then you make that the context, you go get the metadata, you return that service document, and now it's like that user is in his sandboxed environment, or it's like that's how we implemented the multi-tenant OData service. All right, so I took a shortcut right now because like I basically cut out the authentication code right now. So that piece in the provider is commented out because I cannot get to the ACS service reliably over the wired cable, and wireless is pretty bad downstairs. So I'll go, it's like, and figure out what is actually running there. Right. I can then ask for, it's like, okay, what is in there? So run a query. And what you will see is actually that at that point in time, I put a write statement in the query provider. And by default, what I'm doing is I have the query provider implement paging. All right, so I'm asking for the top 50 of this table. It's not very interesting information that is coming down. All right. I can actually do this. I can take 50. All right. And here it's like top 10. So based on what the client actually projects, the provider has to pick this up and walk with it. Right, and if he starts to page, he's like, you basically need to walk from there, which is also like information that you need to keep in your context, because otherwise you will be breaking yourself. Right, so let's actually look what's happening under the covers here. So in order to do that, the easiest way actually is to go to the SQL generator, because as you can imagine, underneath there, we need to generate some SQL code. So we'll go here. So this is where all the interesting stuff happens. So let's just rerun my query right now. Okay, here we go. So the first thing that you actually get is, let's do it like this. I made my font size bigger to help you, but it's actually not helping me right now. Okay. So the main thing is like that you're going after is like, what is it that's being requested from you? All right, so the first level of information is like, what is the entity that you're querying? What is the order by clause that we provide? If you didn't provide one, it automatically expensed on the ID, right? So if you actually added an order by clause. And then it's like what the skip token was that we used. The skip token is just like, how can you actually jump and page, right? And that has to be your a unique key or an identifier, of course. All right. So then it's like you have all the information that you need is like, so if there is a where clause, which there is not right now, otherwise it would show up here. If there is an order by, so there is an order by clause that you can see here. Actually, so let's put that in here. Right. What is the shape of the result set? And then it's like, what is the top count that was actually being returned? And so between skip count and top count, is like you know what your offset is, and that's where you need to land. All right, so that's the mechanism that you're using. So that's the first level information that you actually need to go and figure out is like what you need to build. So in this case, we're actually starting to build up a SQL query that we're going to walk through. All right, so do we have a skip? If we have a skip, we actually would need two select statements. All right, first to create the starting point. Right, and then it's like you need to walk the offset. Otherwise, we just start with a select statement. All right, we have a top statement because we have a top count. All right, we need to build the projection. I'm sorry, I skipped over that. What projection does, it actually goes and walks over my resource types and then constructs my column list in my SQL statement. Right, that's what build projection actually will do. So once I have my projection, then the next thing is like I need to tell it where it comes from. Right? So it's like, again, I need to look up the entity. No, sorry. Yep. Okay. pass that in. All right, do I have a where clause? In this case, I will not add a where clause. All right, so my SQL statement is viewer is also not helping me with this resolution, okay? Then it's like I need to find out if I had an inner query to do the row count. Do I need to add an order by, pass the order by, printing it out for you guys, and then go from there. All right. So that's the basic work that you would have to do. So that gives you sort of the mental model in terms of this is the expression tree that you get handed to you. You need to digest the link expression tree, and then go from there, do your work, and return the right things. Simple, right? Yes?
How is SQL injection?
So the question is, how is SQL injection handled here? Well, in this example, shitty. Right, it's like this is a demo. This is demo code. This is not like the way that right now I'm executing the query. It's like in a real case, you would generate a parameterized query. Yeah. Right, I thought that was too much work. String concatenation is a little bit faster to write demo code, but in reality, it's like yeah, in production, you want to implement this using a parameterized query, right, and then go from there. Or at least do your due diligence in terms of escaping things. It's like there, you should also ask yourself the question is like, what is like the injection question is a little bit more interesting, right? What is it that comes down from the URI, right, all the way down to your generation code, right? It has to be a conformance URI to begin with. You need to do your due diligence with regards to is like it can only reference types that are in there, right? Otherwise, the try resolve would fail. Right? So there are a set of gates, but you're totally right, right? At the end of the day, if you want to do this professionally, this needs to be a parameterized query. Yes. So the question or remark is like we're building against an XML store. Would this be the place where we build the XPath statements? And the answer is yes. That's exactly where you would do this. If you would build, so I have another variation of this that works against the Easy database, right, which is an ISAM database that doesn't have query language. So you need to do seeks and then like find the records and do all the ISAM navigation yourself and then return the information. So Easy is the JET database that sits underneath Active Directory, for those of you who don't know. It's a public API you can get through. There is a .NET wrapper available on CodePlex. But yeah, that's exactly where you do this. This is the place where you do that. So it's like you will see inside the code. I'll get to you in a moment. I saw that you had a question. Hold on. So right now it's like so there are a couple of boilerplate things that we're calling from generate query. All right, so generate query actually will determine if this was a select statement. If not, it's like it will figure out, it's like it will do the insert, delete, and update statements. All right. And so those are the placeholders where you basically go and generate your code. And so I was, my main goal here is to sort of give you a framework where it's like you have some pointers that sort of mentally relates to what you have, and you can then start tweaking it. So it's running, you just change the connection string, and then you're up and running against your database, so you know then where to go. All right, that was the goal. Sir? So the question is, or the remark is like, except for the dynamic part, is this replicating a lot of things that Link2SQL is doing? Yes and no. So there are aspects with regards to query generation that Link2SQL does. And so I'm not going to give you that version, but what I'm using internally is I'm actually taking the expression tree, I'm giving it to the Link2SQL provider to have it generate the query for me. Right? This is actually, this was the first version I actually ever wrote, which was like, what do you do? Well, you're trying to be getting something up and running as fast as you can. And it was educational. It's like a lot of developers who actually made this, took this code and then made it into something real, found it at least useful that they had all the placeholders plugged in. But you're totally, your observation is spot on, right? It's like, in our case, we get an expression, a link expression tree handed. And we have this link provider sitting there. So I can actually leverage that provider, hand it the expression tree, and say, generate me the SQL statement, execute it through my own pipeline, and wire it up. Or use Link2SQL itself. The key thing, though, to remember is that there is another thing that you need to feed into that provider. It needs to have the metadata. Right? Because otherwise, the link provider doesn't know what it reasons over. So that's where we are. So those are the placeholders. And then it's like you can go from there. It's like it actually provides everything. It makes some assumptions. For those of you it's like who don't like English pluralization, it's like it looks at there is a pluralization service. So if you have order, it makes the collection orders. In certain languages, that doesn't translate well, so that code is over here. All right, so you can change that. But beyond that, it's like it actually allows you to go full steam ahead. All right, so let it go. And let's cancel this, and then we'll start to wrap it up. All right, so key things that you have to pay attention to. So the first thing, while implementing a provider or defining your entity set, is that you have to realize that somebody can take the object graph and serialize it on the client, deserialize it, and send it back to you with changes. That's a totally valid scenario, right? That's the ultimate disconnected or occasionally connected system. You ask for some data, you serialize that on the device, you work on it, you change it back. So a couple of remarks about that. So one of the things that we started off with in the project that I did is that I was building a multi-tenant system. And I was also building this over a partitioned set of databases. So my key system that I was exposing wasn't the physical key system. That was problem number one. Problem number two was that if a service would fail over, or I would move a tenant from one node to the other, its physical key system might have changed. So we had a logical and a physical key system. The reason why we had a physical key system is to have optimal performance, right? You want to join on integers, not on strings. Right? The user associates himself, like go back, what was I doing? I was building a directory. What does the user know as his key? Well, his email name is probably an interesting key for the user, right, that he remembers. So the user comes in with one key, and then I need to translate that back. Now, what am I going to give him back as the stable key system? Right. I cannot use the physical key. Now, for most of you, that will not be a problem because you're not having to deal with this complexity. But it's just something to keep in mind, that it's a totally valid scenario that somebody writes a piece of code, takes it, serializes it, sits on it, and then gives it back to you. The other reason, therefore, is that you need to use etags. Right? Etags are the protocol-level implementation of row version. Right? So what SQL Server has is the implementation called row version. What an etag is simply a marker that is being attached to your entity set that says, if this is different than what I gave you, you know that the entity is now invalid. Right? And so you have to use etags. You have to use optimistic concurrency just by nature of the protocol. There is no other way around it. Right? It's HTTP, stateless protocol. You have to be optimistic in terms of concurrency. You will use nav props to compensate for the fact that it's like there is no joining in the language. Right? Although it's like you can project a query, it's like it's your nav props that you're exposing that allows you to navigate relationships. And this was the reason why we actually built the dynamic driver. Because in reality, I'm not looking at the schema as it's being exposed by the database, but I actually had a database, a set of tables that exposed the true relationships. Because we had a relationship table that allows you to express things like, hey, this is a manager of relationship. This is a group membership relationship. This is a security membership relationship. They were all modeled in a single relationship table, right, or represented. But those needed to be reflected as nav props specifically onto the object model because that's what the developer was expecting to see. Right, so there was a lot more complexity behind this at the end. So entity framework is great for prototyping. Right? It might actually get you there all the way, but you have to realize that it's like there is an impedance mismatch between what OData can do and what the protocol can do. Right? And OData can only do so much. It also true with regards to, for example, if you trying to do inheritance, don't. Right? It's like it's not going to. It's like it looks like it will work. Right. But it's like you will not get the inheritance to the other side of the wire. Don't try to go there. Keep your model as simple as possible. Service ops are okay. They're pretty handy with regards to very common tasks where you need to return lists, where you don't want to write out a whole query, or where you want to protect your environment to only certain kinds of inputs. Right, that's another strong use case for service operations. So now what you've seen is the standard out of the box. You can go download WCF Data Services, the November CTP or the latest release. That will have all the things that I just showed you. Right. Now it works inside the WCF framework. And in all honesty, it's like I will tell you, that's like at the end of the day, we stopped using that. Because we have so much load on our servers that we needed to have an asynchronous implementation. And the WCF data services implementation is completely synchronous. What does that mean? It means if you have 500 concurrent sessions, you have 500 stacks. And your stack size is, by default, 2 megabyte on an X64 machine. Do the math. So what we did, not just because of the stack size and the VM size issue, but also because we wanted to have an async async execution mechanism, we switched to OData Lib. What is OData Lib? OData Lib is the underpinning of the new version of WCF Data Services, but it's simply a library that that allows you to handle incoming requests and format the outputs. So it's just the protocol pieces that you need to be able to consume and to produce the OData protocol. Everything else underneath is now up to you. And as that increases your level of complexity, but it actually does improve your cost of the servers by brings it down dramatically, because like you can do async execution and things like that. So it's something to keep in mind so that you know where it sits in the stack. I wouldn't start there by no means. It's like one is built on top of the other, which is a good thing. There is also edmlib, which gives you the metadata library, so that allows you to programmatically reason over the metadata, which is the other part that you need. They go hand in hand. Now, that was the hard version. Then there is actually on CodePlex, there is a WCF Data Services Toolkit, which actually helps you to get going really fast. And so if you have a scenario where you just have a web service and you want to expose that web service as an OData feed, go look at this. You can wire it up in no time and be done. And we actually use this library in production for some of our services ourselves. So it's just targeted at making sure that you don't have to care about the plumbing. You can do all the overrides, the source code is on CodePlex, but it actually shortens your time of delivery of common scenarios like wiring up a web service, wiring up a database, if that was a sample on there that hooks up MySQL directly to an OData service, for example. So there's a lot of things you can do from there. All right. Some resources. OData.org is the only thing that you really have to remember. The blog is still called Astoria Team, which is the original code name. The program manager who is most active and has the most valuable information is Alex James. His blog is on the MSDN website. And so that's where you can read a lot of information if you miss something. And then I think we're at the end of the conference, the session, and the day. Thank you very much.